Life in India's capital city, New Delhi, is being disrupted by mass protests. NPR's Philip Reeves has more.
This has been simmering in India's countryside for days, but today protesters came to the capital. They blocked some roads and rail routes around the city's edge and tried to cut off several of the city's neighbouring new towns and IT hubs, creating huge traffic jams. The demonstrators are from the Gujjar ethnic group. They want their caste reclassified to enable them to qualify under affirmative action laws for government jobs and university places. Many are from the western Indian state of Rajasthan, where protests turned nasty last week when a policeman was lynched. Police then shot dead 36 people after opening fire on demonstrators in a number of towns and villages. Since then, the Gujjars have been blocking roads with some of the victims' corpses. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
A strong earthquake caused some damage in southern Iceland today, but there have been no reports of injuries from the 6.1 magnitude tremor. Residents near the epicenter outside Reykjavik are being told to evacuate their homes because of possible aftershocks. Hurricane warnings are in effect on the coasts of Nicaragua and Honduras, where tropical storm Alma is expected to gain strength today. The region's already seeing torrential rains and top sustained winds of 65 miles per hour. This is the first such storm of the Pacific season. The Atlantic hurricane season begins June 1st. On Wall Street, the Dow is up now 116 points at 12,710 in trading of about 2.5 billion shares. NASDAQ is up now about 29 at 2,516. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from sitforless.com, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including the new color, True Black. sitforless.com.
News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Billy Beru's, Champaign; Inuka Incorporated, Fairmount; Illini Studio, Champaign; Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette; and Remax Realty Associates, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The search for her great-grandmother's ravioli recipe led food historian and journalist Laura Chanone to the homeland of some of her ancestors, Liguria. Eventually, she would discover all the world's a dumpling. Pasta is truly a universal food. She would also learn some things about family. A square of ravioli might be seen as a kind of a metaphor for family. Laura Chanone is our guest in this portion of the program. A recipient of a James Beard Award, she is the author most recently of The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken, A Search for Food and Family. Here is the opening paragraph of Chapter 1 of The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken. A little square of ravioli is like a secret. You look at the outside and see the neatly crimped dough puffed up in the center with a lovely pillow of something mysterious inside. It is an envelope with a message. Before you bite into it, all is unknown and much is still possible. Laura Chanone won a James Beard Award for her first book, A Thousand Years Over a Hot Stove, A History of American Women Told Through Food Recipes and Remembrances. It is a history of American women told through the lens of the kitchen. It was that book that got Laura Chanone thinking about her culinary roots. The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken, A Search for Food and Family, is published by W.W. Norton. And you'll find our guest, Laura Chanone, on the web at www.laurachanone.com. And her name is spelled S-C-H-E-N-O-N-E. Laura, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Celeste. I loved hearing you read that first paragraph. You did it so nicely.
Oh, it's so beautifully written.
Thank you.
It's so beautifully written. And this book is, it's just good.
Thank you.
Early in the book, you tell readers how this journey began. It began, you say, with the beginnings of a yearning. What were you yearning for and why?
Right. Well, that is even the hardest thing to explain even now, but I think if I kind of describe it generally, maybe people will understand. I was in my early 40s and living a fairly settled life. I was benefiting from all the things that my ancestors, I guess, had done with immigration, and I'm a third generation, very mixed ethnicity, and living the suburban life, but feeling like something was missing, and it had to do with maybe wishing more for culture and history, feeling the incredible speed of life and the disposability of modern life. I live, 12 miles outside of New York, and things move very quickly here in the suburbs. And I suppose, a sense of midlife mortality, wondering, well, where do I come from and what will be here when I am gone, made me start to search for something in history that I felt could feel connected to. Also, I had done this first book. I spent many years working on 1,000 Years Over a Hot Stove. That was a history of American women through food. So I started to wonder, well, what is my culinary history? Where do I fit in? So that's where I got the initial idea. So it's a combination of just, yes, there's this factual thing. I had done this big research, but there was some yearning and desire in me for something, maybe to find something big and beautiful I could be part of. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
It's a long answer.
So why ravioli?
Well, I wanted the thing that got me started was I wanted to find a family recipe, because if you look, probably if many Americans look at what they cook every day, they're not going to see much history in it. There's a lot of us cooking quick meals, whatever we saw in the Wednesday section of the food section, or we cook from cookbooks. Not that many people, and the ones who are, I think, are lucky, cook from recipes that were passed down. So I decided I wanted to find at least one important recipe that was not from a cookbook, that dated before commercial food and packaged food. So first I went up the mother line of my family. My grandmother was Croatian, from this beautiful part of the Dalmatian coast, basically a Mediterranean area. And I went there, and I could not find anything that reflected my personal history. Everything had been lost. My great-grandmother had abandoned her children for a lover, mm-hmm. and my grandmother grew up without a mother, so she had no history. So there was nothing there for me to reclaim. But I did recall then that on my father's side of the family, there was stories of this ravioli, and in the kitchen that I grew up in, there was a ravioli tool that hung on the wall that no one knew what to do with anymore. So I decided to look into it, and those ancestors, I have their name. It's Scanone in Italian. They were from the Genoa area, and it turned out that I didn't have to do much research to find out that in Genoa, ravioli is really a sacred food, a food of happy times, of family togetherness, a real cultural icon with very deep roots. And so I knew that would be the food I wanted to learn to make and bring back.
Yeah, it's really interesting to learn that once upon a time in Italy, pasta was a luxury.
Yes, that is a shock, isn't it? That's why a lot of Italians came to this country in the 19th century, particularly from the south. Liguria, where I'm writing about, is from the north, but there was plenty of hunger there also, but particularly in the south. People were very hungry in the 19th century. There was just a lot of population expansion, and so many Italians had to leave. They did not eat pasta a lot at home. It was a luxury. And the irony is that for so many Italians, They couldn't eat real Italian food until they left Italy and came to the U.S. and had some money and could import the foods that they had always been hungering for. It's quite an interesting paradox.
Yeah, it is. Leaving home to eat the food of home, you say.
Yeah, you couldn't eat Italian until they could go somewhere where they weren't starving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Needless to say, food is very important in the culture. How is that revealed today?
Oh, my God, everywhere you turn. I mean, I got into this. I was not looking to write about food. I was very interested in literature, and I was, you know, working on my novel when I was about 30 or whatever. And somehow I had an experience, actually, in life where my husband and I wound up moving to the country for a while and renting a farmhouse. And I really was not expecting to write about food, but while I was at this farmhouse, I had this big garden, and it hit me then that food is so intertwined with everything we do in life. So to say, you know, how do you see it in the culture? Once you put on that lens where you realize that food is a doorway, and it has always held up for me. That was more than 10 years ago that I realized it, and I still see so much of culture through food. Social class, especially in this country, there's a lot of social class, a little more here than in Italy. Ethnicity, history. This country is was so created by technology that's very apparent in our food. Regionalism, all kinds of ideals, hopes, dreams, religion. It's all there in food.
Yeah. At the same time, I'm recalling now a scene from early in the book when you're telling us about how it was that you started out on this journey, and you see your sons with food coming out of plastic tubes, and they want aqua blue cereals, and
yellow food dye number, or whatever it is.
Yeah,
right?
And you know, the list of ingredients.
I think a lot of us, that added to my sense of being deracinated, seeing the foods my kids were eating. It's just a constant... it's a big struggle when you're in that phase of life where you're raising children. And if you have a lot of awareness about food, you do feel, you know, advertising and culture coming at you so strong for a lot of junk food. And there the kids want it. So that also did impel me to feel like I want something deeper and more meaningful. And my kids, actually, if you ask them what their favorite food is, they do love ravioli. Who wouldn't? Who doesn't love ravioli?
That's so true.
Right.
And you know, kids, they can pick it up with their fingers.
Yeah, they love it. Yeah.
Now, you say that when you were a young woman, you would never have dreamed that you would seek and find so much joy in the kitchen. How did you find your way to the kitchen?
Well, first it was that farmhouse experience, growing my own vegetables and living in this historic structure. I lived in a really old building for a while with my husband before we had kids. And it was there. I spent a lot of time alone there. I did become aware of the ghosts of the women who came before me. But so I started to get more aware, and I was raised in a family where food seemed very, very important. But I also noticed, you know, for the women I witnessed in my life, food had a form of both oppression for them. They spent an awful lot of their lives in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But it also seemed to me that it had a great amount of power in bringing people together. That was very important in my family. So that paradox was always working on me. You know, is it oppression? Is it power? And I think it's still a bit of both. But as a young woman, I really wanted to be free of it. And it wasn't until I had my own children, and that you just by necessity, you're cooking all the time, you're caring for them, you start to become more aware and wonder, what am I really doing? What am I feeding them? What, you know, what matters?
Yeah. What was your family's kitchen like when you were growing up?
I grew up in a, you know, of course, in the book, you know, the search for ravioli is the search for ravioli and becomes quite the journey to find it. But it also, as you know, is a search for happiness and family happiness. And I do tell the whole family story in the book. It's really a family memoir in many ways. So about the kitchen I grew up in, it was very ordinary. We were working class. There was, you know, I think orange formica around and all kinds of stuff. But it was very functional. There was a table in the kitchen, which I think is the best thing in the world. I don't have that now. And I think that's a great thing. And we spent so much time there because my mother and grandmother were really tremendous cooks. they were always there, and it was not lavish. And as I said, we were working class. But in the kitchen, there was a certain, safety for me, being with the women of the family and hearing the stories. And that was when my mother was cooking. She had time to talk to me and my grandmother, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I really absorbed a lot. It seems very natural to me that food and stories and family stories would go together. That's kind of how a lot of the stories were told to me.
Yeah.
We were peeling carrots.
Did you do your homework at the kitchen table?
I don't know. No, I didn't.
You didn't.
I had
okay.
a desk. Nope. I spent a lot of time in the kitchen, though.
Yeah. So did I.
Did you eat dinner in the kitchen?
Yes, we did.
We had a dining room, but we always ate dinner.
Yeah, we didn't use the dining room for a dining room.
No.
Well, the kitchen was actually the middle of the house, and it was a nice big room. It had pink formica.
Yeah, see? But, you know, I grew up in one of those families where, you know, my mother, she baked a cake every week, and there was a cake tin on the counter, and there was always a homemade cake there, and people used to drop by our house all the time, and there was always some coffee on the stove, and people would just show up for coffee and cake. And that doesn't happen anymore in this world. I don't know. Maybe in Illinois it does. It doesn't.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah. I hope it does.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a warm room, and it was a big room, and there was a great big round table, and so much of our lives took place
there. So much of your life goes on at the table.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Laura Chanone is our guest this afternoon here on the program. She's the author most recently of The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken, A Search for Food and Family. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. We'd like to hear from you this afternoon, your questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us about your father, and what did he think of this search for ravioli and family?
Right. Well, the tricky business of searching for a recipe that came from his side of the family was that I had to deal with him. And it would have been easier to deal with my mother. My father is a very private man. He's quite reserved. He has he can be warm at times, but I'd always had some struggles knowing him and being entirely at ease with him in my life. So when I went to broach him, and you know, it's interesting, you're a totally grown woman, but these things are still inside you, nervousness around my dad. So when I went to ask him about this, I didn't know how he'd respond, but he was quite delighted, it turns out, and he was enthusiastic. He remembered the ravioli from his childhood with such great memories. For me, I had the ravioli when I was young, but I didn't even remember it. His aunt Tessie, my great aunt, made it, and I was just very young whenever I had it. I had no real memory, but he had tremendous memories, and he said, I'll give you to my cousins. He had a collection of cousins who were quite a bit older than him and knew his grandmother, who was from Italy, and he said, you better get them soon because they're old if you want this recipe. So he was quite enthusiastic, and he sent me to his cousins.
Yeah, one of them was Cousin Catherine.
Oh, she turned out to be my favorite. One of the best things about this book, actually probably the best thing, was the people I met in my journey. Family here that I didn't know, and just all kinds of people in Liguria when I went there. Catherine was this incredibly bright human being, an inspiration in her 80s, full of life, still pretty, still full of zest. And not because she had an easy life either, because she had not, but she was raised by her grandmother, Adalgisa. And it was Adalgisa who brought the recipe from Genoa. And the reason why she was raised by Adalgisa was because her mother was sick and hospitalized for most of her life. So her tragedy meant that her grandmother stepped in. And for me, it meant that I found a living link in her 80s with a wonderful memory, a living link to my great-grandmother who could really remember her and tell me about her. So that was tremendous. Plus, she was so warm and honest with me.
Yeah, and what did she tell you about your grandmother, Adalgisa?
My great-grandmother, Adalgisa.
Yeah.
Well, she told me what I thought was so important about Adelgisa and Salvatore. There was a love story there. Adelgisa was a very strong woman, very spunky. But the story that she had been told by Adelgisa herself was that she came from a decent family in Recco, Italy, which is near Genoa, and she was betrothed to some decent guy, a soldier. You know, they weren't rich, but okay. She lived in a nice house, is the way I was told. But somehow or another, we don't know how, she fell in love with Salvatore, and he was poor as anything, and he came down from the mountains to see her, because they are the poor people who lived in the mountains. And somehow or another, she decided not to marry the soldier and to marry Salvatore. And her father was very mad, but she obviously was strong enough that she got her way. But the best part of the story was that Salvatore would come down from the mountains with a mandolin and sing under her window. And, of course, I love that.
Yeah. When did they come to America?
That is not entirely clear. Salvatore came. There's still some mystery. I have his documents from the 1890s. I have not found her. The only ship manifest I found for her is, I think, 1907, and I know she was not alone that long. There's still some mystery as to when she came, but I do know that it's not always so easy finding these documents.
Yeah.
No. But I do know that he came first, which was very typical of Italian immigrants at the time. It's so interesting, you know, with the different ethnic groups in America, each has its own patterns. You know, for example, the Jews that came from Eastern Europe, they often came as a family and never looked back because they were so persecuted. And in the Irish culture, it was often women who came first. Mm-hmm. But in Italy, it was very often men who came, always with the plans, or usually with the plans of returning. And then maybe they wouldn't, or they'd come back and forth, and eventually the wife and children would follow. So the story was that Salvatore went first, and then some other relatives told me that he was gone, and he was supposed to send the money for Adelgisa, and it wasn't coming, and then she got word that he was fooling around in America. And she was very unhappy, and she packed up her kids, got them on a boat, and went back to go set things right and reclaim her husband. So she was a strong woman.
Yeah. In my family, on my mother's side, we go back quite a way. We've been in the United States for a long time, but on my father's side, it's much more recent. But in both cases, it was women who came, and they were orphans.
Mm.
You know, and
how did that happen? How would an orphan find her way?
Well,
here?
There were older children, mm-hmm. and so the older children looked after the younger children.
Mm.
And so they made their way here. That's on my father's side.
Mm.
And they were all girls who came. One son, one brother remained in Ireland. And then on my mom's side, the story is that these two girls, twins, were orphaned because their parents were killed by the English. The story in the family is, and who knows if this is true, that the parents were hanged as spies. It's a great story, but I don't know if it's true or
not.
And then these two girls, they were somehow or other, they came under the protection of a Norwegian sailor, a captain of a boat. Mm. And he took them to America.
And what did they do here?
You know, that's part of the sadness of this story is I really don't know much about this at all.
Yeah. It's an amazing country with all these stories of immigration. It's really the most fascinating thing.
Yeah. And on my father's side, the parents there, my grandmother's parents were, they died, I think they just became, they were sick, they got sick and died. So any advice for us in terms of, from your experience, in terms of tracking down stories like these?
Yeah, first of all, you have to know that they are stories. And as you said, who knows if it's true. But they're still valuable to hear, even the stories. You know, I was not writing this book as a technician. You know, I did have some genealogists write to me and say, this is an interesting way to do genealogy through a recipe. But I was really trying to understand some questions about the nature of family and how to hold family together. So to me, the stories people tell, whether they're, you know, I'm interested in what family means to people as much as what actually happened. And people reveal a lot when they tell you the stories they remember. So they take on a life of their own, even if they're not true. So the answer is talk to the older relatives while you still can. That's the most important thing. And write things down. And know that they may and may not be true. Don't just believe things because people tell you, but listen anyway, because there's some element of truth there. And you will get differing sides of the story. And then, of course, ellisisland.org. You can look up names of ancestors. Really, you can do very wonderful things just from the Internet in your own home. That's a start. And then it's good to go to the place where they came from if you really want to know some things. Now, of course, if it's 100 years later, it's a different place. But it depends on where you're going. You know, there may still be things there and people to find. Everything, it depends on the individual case. But I went to Genoa the first time having very little clue, and each visit I knew a little more about who they were. I went 3 times to do this book, and of course that's part of the journey of the book is, you know, you asked about the kitchen. I grew up in, a pretty working class part of New Jersey that's rather grim visually as the landscape, a lot of it. And to go to Italy and see that they'd come from what now looks like such a beautiful place. Of course, if you were hungry and poor back then, it you know, you would have perceived it differently. But that gave me a lot of understanding.
Yeah. There's a story that opens the book. It's a prologue, and it's a little story that deals with these very themes that we're talking about.
Right.
That you can move forward, you can leave, but, you know, what do you lose?
Right.
Right.
What do we lose? What do we leave behind when we leave? And I think that especially you see that a lot in immigrants today. For those of us who've been here for 2 or 3 or more generations, I think we still lose things, but this is the way the world is. But for those who are just coming now, it's so hard to be an immigrant. And you do leave things behind that you never retrieve.
Yeah. As a result of this search for family, and as a result of writing this book, The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken, do you tell family stories to your sons more than you had in the past?
I think the joy of this is the joyful part of the book, was that they got to see where some of their ancestors came from. On the final trip, I took them to Liguria, and it was one of the greatest experiences of my life to take my whole family there, my husband and my sons. And they have it burned into their brains that they have some ancestry there in this beautiful place, and I know it means something to them. They idealize it, and then that's the interesting thing, too. You know, we mythicize the past, and I see they have mythicized Italy to some extent. I actually, as boys, they're now 12 and 7, and they're not terribly interested in the past. They don't need it. Children are so wonderful the way they live in the present. But I do feel like I left behind for them some of these stories. I left behind a lot about myself, and I hope that it's an invitation to them to continue to try to understand, you know, the meaning of family and to take from it, hopefully, some value that they can use in their lives. And I feel like it'll be there for them when they want to read it and someday really know their mother.
Yeah, yeah. It seems that there is an awful lot of pride in ethnicity, but at the same time, has it always been kind of a fuzzy story, a collection of myths? And on the other hand, is ethnicity disappearing, except for maybe our newest immigrants?
Right. Well, these are the complicated questions. Will ethnicity disappear and blur? There's some interesting responses to that. There's a framing thing about ethnicity. You know, the desire to belong is so great, to feel a part of something. It's so powerful, and it can be really a beautiful thing to belong to a family or a tribe. But then there's a part where it can get really ugly, where people hate one another and do terrible things. So it is something that you need to watch and be aware of. I don't have any easy answers for that because I do understand that pull to belong is so strong and feel part of something.
Mm.
The world obviously is moving so much more quickly. People are so migratory. An interesting side effect, though, to technology is that I think people have been able to keep their ethnicity in certain ways and promote it partly through the Internet. And in the book, the most fascinating thing to me is that I was looking for my pre-electronic origins, you know, my real roots. And the thing that really enabled me to find that recipe and find the people who could teach me was the Internet. I received a letter one day, an email from a woman who said, my name is Maria Luisa Scannone. I'm from Lumazzo, Italy, just near Genoa. I know your family's from Lumazzo because all persons in Lumazzo are named Shannon. And I became friendly with this woman over the Internet. It was crazy that she sent me this email out of the blue through my website right when I was doing this research. And I asked her some questions about true Genoese ravioli. Because, you know, just to take a step back, when my relatives did give me that recipe, they sent me a recipe for Genoese ravioli mm-hmm. that disappointed me. It was made with commercial ingredients. The big ingredient was Philadelphia cream cheese and frozen spinach, and I was horrified. So what really set me on the quest was this idea of authenticity. I wanted to find a real recipe. So I started to write to Maria Luisa and ask her some questions about it, and she said, my 91-year-old mother still makes ravioli all the time. If you come here, she'll show you. So naturally, I found the wherewithal to get myself there, and I met Giuseppina, her mother, who showed me how to roll with a pin, and it was because of the Internet that I could get there. Also, one of my great, you know, I had a tremendous mentor in the book named Sergio Rossi. I met him through the Internet, through some food historian group. And then when I really needed to learn how to roll this pasta on a rolling pin, that was the goal, was how to learn it on a big stick like my great-grandmother did, not with a machine. The way I really remembered was I took a video camera with me, and I filmed someone, and I brought it home to my kitchen, and I practiced a million times watching this video. So the technology really is what helped me reclaim this piece of ethnicity. So it's interesting. You know, there has been a rise of ethnicity, gourmet foods, and memories of old foodways, and all this recipe sharing and information, even ingredients that you never used to be able to buy. People were forced to become Americanized because they couldn't take a plane back, they couldn't phone call, they didn't have access to this technology. So in some ways, it's an interesting dynamic. I think we're not quite sure how it will evolve and unfold over the years.
Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful picture of you on the jacket of the book in the back, where your little biographical sketch is, and there you are with the rolling pin.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting that technology brought you to a rolling pin and to this the press that actually hung for a long time in your family's kitchen, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I in reaching out to these relatives, I also tell a story in the book about my father's family and the falling apart of his family. One of the things that always made my father a remote kind of guy was that his family, it didn't really work out for him, and he wound up with no family. So the search for this ravioli that's the ultimate family happiness is very ironic sort of thing. But as I reach around to the relatives to tell me the story, one day Catherine, who we talked about earlier, took me to the cemetery to see the graves of Salvatore and Adelgis and the whole family. And when we're coming home, her daughter, who had gone with us, said, would you like to step inside? I want to show you something. And I stepped inside her house, and I had not known this cousin. I had not been in touch with her. It was only because of this quest. And she pulled down from the top of her cupboard this long stick, 3 feet long. And she said, this is Adelgis' rolling pin. And, you know, if you'd like to borrow it for a while, you can have it. And I kept it for about a year, and that's how I learned. So that was almost a more magical element to me. You know, we went from her grave, and then this rolling pin emerged.
Yeah, it's also interesting, all the tools that you found along the way.
Yeah, all these cousins. I discovered a trail of relatives, you know, second and third cousins all across the country. And it was who had the ravioli lifter, who had a ravioli press out in Washington State, in Oregon, in Wyoming, in Florida. And these relatives that I met were very kind to me, They sent me audio recordings. You know, I got to actually hear Adele G's voice and tools and photos. It's interesting when you reach out, you know, you do something crazy like that. When I first called some of them and said, I'm looking for this recipe, can you help me? And I'm your cousin Peter's daughter, who you haven't seen in 20 years. They were very curious about the whole thing. But in the end, it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, and you found a cousin who has a ravioli press made from the wood of that name could not trip
off. Adalgisa.
Adalgisa.
They called her Adele, I think, for sure.
Adele.
Okay. Yeah, her bed.
Her wedding bed.
Yeah, that's what they say, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, you wonder, was that just...
Is it true? Could it possibly be true?
Is it true, and was it just a practical matter, or was it a romantic kind of thing to do?
It's so romantic that it's kind of irresistible, yeah.
Well,
I never saw it. She's out in Washington State, so I never got to verify.
Another great story.
Yeah.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Laura Chanone. Her most recent book, The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken, A Search for Food and Family. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So how long did it take you to feel comfortable with that pin and
right.
the press?
Well, as we were talking about technology earlier, when I first saw, you know, pasta rolled out on a stick, it had this slapping, stretching method. When you make pasta in a machine, you're just pressing it through rollers, and it comes out very lovely and nice, but it's not the same as something that's made on a pin the old-fashioned way. That's a rougher product, and you're stretching it and flipping it, and it slaps the board as it grows, so it's a little more porous. And there is like a mechanic to knowing how to handle it and do it. And when I did see Giuseppina in Lumarzo do it, I came home and I couldn't do it myself, so I forgot. So that's when I went back with the video camera, and a wonderful guy named Roberto in a beautiful restaurant in LaGuardia showed me how to do it. So I came home and I said, I'm going to do this every day until I get it. And I had Adele G's pin, and I set up that little thing every day. And I would say that I did it for 3 weeks every day. So, you know, 20 before I really felt like I was getting it. It's a lot in the hands. And I still don't consider myself an expert by any stretch, but I do it all the time. And, you know, I wasn't raised with it. And I still am always having questions, you know, about how much liquid to put into the dough, and do they make their ravioli a little more al dente in Rome and pasta a little thinner in Liguria. Pasta is a universe. You know, there's so many shapes and things to do.
Mm-hmm.
I could be learning my whole life. But I would say it took a few weeks every day to really feel like I could get it nice and thin.
What is the ravioli of Genoa like? What is it? Yeah, what is it?
It's a very rich ravioli that would be typical for Christmas. And then the question is, that was actually my question, what is it? What is it supposed to be? The recipe I got from my relatives called for chopped veal, chopped pork, cream cheese, frozen spinach, egg, and Reggiano cheese, maybe a few seasonings and spices, all mixed up together raw, spread on the dough, and then the meat cooks in the water. That is not at all a typical Italian technique. Usually you would braise your meat. So that was one mystery to solve. The other was the cream cheese. What was the cream cheese in Liguria? What were they thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out there are Genoese people all over America who use cream cheese as a substitute for a cheese called Prescenzua, which is a very local fresh cheese. But to answer your question, what is ravioli in Genoa? Genoa is a whole region, and it varies from village to village, from family to family. But the general concept is that it's going to be some kind of braised meat. It might have been organ meats in the 19th century. There might have been brains in it or, you know, whatever. But generally today it would be pork and veal. It might have some organs in it. Braised, which means slowly cooked, like a pot roast till it's really soft and melty. In your pot, depending on how wealthy or how good of a cook you are, you might have bay leaf, pinoli nuts, rosemary, onion, carrots, you know, all the aromatics that would go in there while you're cooking that meat down. So it becomes sweet and soft. And then you put it through a grinder and you add some over there. They use a green called borage, boragine, borage. We don't really use it here, so we would use spinach or escarole. So you mix that in there. Always in Liguria, there's greens, so that has to go in there. You might put marjoram, which is a very fragrant herb they love there. Eggs, the best Reggiano that you can find. A little nutmeg, a little medieval trace there. Is this enough? Then you mix the whole thing together, and you have this very rich meat filling. And you put it in your ravioli. You roll out your dough. The way I do it is I make a big circle, and I fill half the circle with the meat filling. And then I close the top half of the dough on top, and I roll over it with a checkered ravioli rolling pin that makes the squares. And then I cut it with a little ravioli cutter. They dry, and then you serve them in a tomato sauce that has a meat in it. And they call it their tuku, the dialect word for meat sauce.
Sounds,
the day's work, let me tell you.
It sounds wonderful. Well, when we make pasta, we do them with the machine, and that's a lot of work if you make a filled pasta.
Right. For me now, that's not even that. You can become very mechanized if you really know what you're doing. But, yeah, it's a big job.
It's like,
I would make for Christmas time, I make the filling the day before. And then I have it done. And then the next day is the rolling of the pasta and the assembling and the drying. And then I put them in the freezer, which, of course, Adalgisa didn't have. And then I can scrape them off in plastic bags, and they don't stick with one another. And I always think, okay, I'm making 300. I'm making 500. I'll have so many left over. And then they're gone. They're just gone. They take forever to make, and they get inhaled in 5 minutes.
Well, it's good to know with practice, you can...
Oh, absolutely. You can make a cheese, simple cheese ravioli in an hour, and it's so much better than what you buy. There's nothing like it.
Yeah. Now, would you ever put a pesto sauce on the ravioli in Liguria?
Well, it's interesting. I did do that, and I have, but that's not what they do in Genoa. Pesto is the Genoese sauce, you know, as you obviously know. Pesto comes from Genoa, and they have some very strict ideas about what you put pesto on. And ravioli is not one of them. But certainly you can. In fact, Sever magazine just did a little piece on my book, and they did a recipe inspired by it, which was mushroom ravioli with pesto. That's not authentic Genoese, but it's really very good.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
That's okay. We're Americans, so we are not beholden to these strict traditions.
Your great-grandmother knew that.
That's right. She came here, she used cream cheese, and it was just fine.
Yeah. Well, growing up, we had some Italian friends, and at that point in time, these ingredients were not around,
right.
Like ricotta cheese. So they used cottage cheese, and they used cream cheese as well. So,
see?
So you work with what you got.
Well, you know, there's an idea about food and authenticity, and this is what I try to get at in the book. You know, in the end, I have to have someone bang it over the head for me, you know, this friend of mine. There is no one recipe. And, you know, maybe authenticity is not always about having the exact ingredients. There was a wonderful woman I spoke with in my first book. She was an Indian scholar, Native American. And she said, you know, the foods can change as much as possible, as much as they have to. Indians lost their land, they're put on reservations, but it's really the meanings that you bring to the food that can be almost as important, or maybe more important. When I was in Liguria, I spoke with a wonderful scholar there, a wise person. They said to me, we're interested in saving food. And I said, well, how are you going to do that? We had this long talk, and I said, well, how are you going to save these traditions? He said, oh, we don't care about the traditions of food. The traditions are always changing. It's the culture of the food here we want to keep. And that idea is the bedrock, you know. What is that bedrock, that elusive thing where what's important is still there, whether or not you change from ricotta to cottage cheese? Maybe it's that you have your family together and you make it on Christmas because it's important. And maybe that's the most symbolic and meaningful thing.
Yeah, well, it's back to the story you tell in the prologue about how stories change. They get retold, and they take on another little twist or turn here and there.
Right. I just wanted, when I wrote this book, to keep track of what would be important to hold on to.
Yeah.
Despite all those changes.
Well, there are recipes in the back of the book that I think people would be interested in looking at and trying. And one of the things that I am looking forward to trying is gnocchi. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Gnocchi. Yes.
And I've had it, and it can be so wonderful, and it can be terrible.
Right.
And I guess the secret is, from reading your recipe, is a light hand and a ricer.
Yes, I think the ricer is very good. And a good thing, they always tell you to bake the potatoes, but to put them in water. I like to bake them in the oven. The less water in your potatoes or in your dough, the less liquid, then the less heavy they will be. So you do them without water, and then you rice them while they're still hot so that they become light. And you spread them out, all your potato fluff, on like a cookie sheet and let it cool. And then you work with it with a very light hand, and that's how you don't get those leaden bullets.
They're like, whoa.
Yes.
And what in Liguria, how would they sauce this dish they also call trophy?
Trophy. Well, you know, that's interesting. I have a recipe in there for a trofie that I love that is with chestnut flour. And that you can have with pesto. Chestnuts, many people don't know, but in northern Italy, that is a real staple for people in the mountains in the northern part who were poor and even made bread out of chestnut flowers and built their home out of chestnuts and ate chestnut. I love the smoky taste of the chestnut in the gnocchi with pesto sauce. It's a wonderful thing.
Is it relatively easy to get chestnut flour? I guess you can turn to the internet.
You have to go to the internet, and I did a lot of work to find it. It's not the same as what I get in Liguria, but it's very good. Yes, you can get it on the internet, and I have resources in the book. It's a wonderful, earthy, sweet, smoky flavor, and you mix it with half wheat, regular, you know, wheat flour, and it's really cool.
We're out of time. It flew by. Laura, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
It was fabulous. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Laura Chanone is the author of The Lost Ravioli Recipes of Hoboken, A Search for Food and Family. The publisher is W.W. Norton. You'll find our guest on the web at www.laurachanone.com. And her name is spelled S-C-H-E-N-O-N-E.
And it's 1:51 on the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn returns, by the way, next Tuesday. I'm Jay Pierce sitting in today, and our technical director is Jason Croft. Right now, Dave Dickey joins us from the Agriculture Office, and we have the highs, lows, and settlements from the commodity markets from Dave.
Thank you very much, Jay, and good afternoon, everyone. Today, the CFTC led a bombshell into Trader Picks when it announced that it has launched and has been for some time, all the way back to last December, investigating the purchase, transportation, storage, and trading of oil and related derivative contracts. That, along with a higher U.S. dollar, sent some ripples through the market, and all commodities, both soft and hard commodities, grain commodities, derivatives, all have suffered losses today of one kind or another. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars in Kansas City and at the Chicago Board of Trade. And we'll begin, as we usually do, in the Kansas City wheat pit, which had a high price on the day of $8.05, a low of $7.82, settling $7.94, down 9.5. December, a high of $8.32.75, a low of $8.14, settling $8.27, down 7. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high of $7.62.5, a low of $7.30.75, settling $7.43.5, down 15.5. September, a high of $7.76.25, a low of $7.46.5, settling $7.59.25, down 15.25. December, a high of $7.98, a low of 768, settling 781, down 15 and a quarter. March of 2009, a high of 818, a low of 790, settling $8.50, down 14 and a half. July of 2009, a high of 829 and a quarter, a low of 808, settling 822, down 13. Take it out to December of 2009, a high of 865, a low of 839, settling 852, down 13. July corn, a high of 594 and three quarters, a low of 572 and three quarters, settling 582 and a quarter, down 10 and a quarter. September, a high of 607 and three quarters, a low of 586, settling 595 and a quarter, down 10 and a quarter. December, a high of 621 and three quarters, a low of 599 and three quarters, settling 609 and a half, down 10. March of 2009, a high of 635, a low of 614, settling 623, down 10. May, a high of 641 and a quarter, a low of 623, settling 631 and three quarters, down 9 and three quarters. July, a high of 648 and a half, a low of 628 and three quarters, settling 638 and a quarter, down 9 and three quarters. December, a high of 609 and a quarter, a low of 585 and a quarter, settling 595, down 13 and a half. March of 2010, a high of 605, a low of 593 and a half, settling 602, down 13 and one half. July oats, a high of 1388, a low of 1376 and a quarter, settling 1382, down 8. September, a high of 1396, a low of 1388 and a half, settling 396 for the high, 388 and a half for the low, 393 and a half, the settlement there, down 7 and a half. July beans, a high of 1376, a low of 1307 and three quarters, settling 1322 and three quarters, down 50. August, a high of 1379, a low of 1312 and three quarters, settling 1328, down 47 and a half. September, a high of 1364, a low of 1307 and a quarter, settling 1322, down 40 and a quarter. November, a high of 1360 and three quarters, a low of 1305, settling 1321 and a half, down 35 and three quarters. January of 2009, a high of 1370, a low of 1320, settling 1335 and a half, down 35 and a half. March of 2009, a high of 1381 and a half, a low of 1331 and three quarters, settling 1346 and a half, down 35 and a half. Out to November of 2009, a high of 1359 and a half, a low of 1305 and a half, settling 1321 and a half, down 36 and three quarters. July soybean meal, a high of 344.60, a low of 327.50, settling 331.80, down 11.90. August, a high of 346.30, for the high there, the low at 330.50, settling 334.60, down 11.20. July soybean oil, a high of 62.94, a low of 60.15, settling 60.30, down 2.35. August, a high of $63, a low of 60.48, settling 60.65, down $2.33. Take a quick look at outside markets for you. July crude at 126.85 is down 4.18. It's been as low today as 126.69. August, 127.69, down 3.30. CRB at 418 is off almost 10 points, while the gold contracts settlement there in the August contract, 881.70, off $23.30. Settlement prices are coming your way in just a moment from CME Livestock. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Well, first of all, live cattle for June on the Merck had a high price of $96.95 today, low of $95.70, settled at $95.95, down 77 and a half. August had a high of $101.85, a low of $160, and the settlement was $100.92.5, and that was up, I make that down 70. October had a high of $108.15, a low of $106.95, settlement $107.45, down 62.5. December, $108.80 for the high, $107.70 the low, $107.92.5 was the settlement, down 60. August feeder cattle had a high of $116.15, a low of $115.40, the settlement $115.45, down 35. September had a high of $116.90 and a low of $116 even. Settlement was $116.27.5, down 32.5. October had a high of $117.45.5, a low of $116.60. The settlement was $117.02.5, down 30. And November had a high of $117.75, a low of $116.80, settlement $117.40, down 5. The lean hogs for June had a high of $76.75, a low of $76. The settlement was $76.17.5, down 57.5. July had a high of $77.10, a low of $75.70. Settlement was $76.25, and that was up 20. And the frozen pork bellies for July had a high of $76.17.5, a low of $73.50. The settlement $75.75, up 2.55. And the August contract had a high of $76.15, a low of $74.30. Settlement $75.60, up 2.45. It's 2.